One of these overeducated people who can't remember to turn on a mic. The topic for this session is economics. This is going to, as you'll see, there'll be some connections to politics as well. But it turns out that, again, when you're looking at approaches to economics in the Western world, particularly in the modern West, these things all, again, have their roots within the Christian tradition. And so what I'm going to do here is I'm going to walk you through, again, a few of the areas. This isn't obviously comprehensive, but a few of the areas that shape our views of economics today and where they come from. And as you'll see, most of them come straight out of the Bible and medieval theological reflections on it. So the place I want to start with is with the notion of work. Now, in the ancient world, the world where Jesus lived, and frankly, the world pretty much throughout the period when the Bible was written, there was an attitude toward work that was really pretty negative. Basically, it said that work was something that was toil, it was drudgery, it had really no particular value except it was necessary, and therefore the only people who should engage in work are inferiors like slaves and the lower classes. Okay. If you look at, for example, ancient Middle Eastern myths about the creation, what they say is that there was a war between two sets of gods, and one of the sets of gods lost the war, and the winning gods enslaved them, and they made them do the work. Those gods then complained to the winning gods, and they said to them, hey, look, we're gods too. We shouldn't have to do this stuff. And the winning gods said, well, yeah, I guess suppose it is beneath your dignity. So they made human beings to do the work so that the enslaved gods didn't have to do it. That tells you a lot about what they thought about people, but also what they thought about work. It's also true in the Greco-Roman world. Slaves and the lower classes are the ones who did the work. Anybody who was in any way superior in the upper classes or things like that did not work and, in fact, spent their time contemplating beauty and leisure activities and things of that sort or participating in government. Early on, that wasn't the case, but by the time you're getting to the Roman Empire, it emphatically is. Now, there's one exception to this in the ancient world, and that's the Jews. Because the Jews had a radically different view of work, and this ends up communicating itself into Christianity, and it actually begins in Genesis. And it starts with the idea that human beings are made in the image of God. The image of God in the ancient Near East meant something specific. Theologians argue all the time about what the image of God is. Is it contained in human rationality, or is it spirituality, morality? What is it? Well, any Old Testament scholar can give you the answer to that pretty quickly. In the ancient Near East, the world in which Genesis was written, when someone claimed to be the image of a god, it's a polytheistic system, remember, when someone said they were the image of a god, what it meant is that they were claiming that that god had given them authority to rule as his representative or regent over the world. So what it was, the idea of image of God conveyed with it the idea of rulership, but the idea of a delegated rulership from a god as that god's representative, that his steward, his regent, something like that in the world. So when Genesis says, God says to himself, let us make man in our image and in our likeness, and let us give them dominion over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air and everything that creeps on the land. He's actually explaining what the image of God is. It is contained in this idea of dominion. When Genesis, and you'll notice, if you read Genesis, every time in Genesis 1, where it talks about human beings made in the image of God, it immediately goes to this idea of having authority over the world. Now, it isn't the authority of a ruler in the usual sense of the word. It's the authority of a steward. The earth remains God's, but we, as his official representative and regent on the earth, get to run it in his name. That's the concept. And actually, if you read through it, you'll notice that when God creates man in his image, male and female, he also said, you know, he says, let them have dominion. And that is connected with two things, reproduce and multiply, create families, create society, and rule and have dominion and rule over the world. Okay, so those are the two aspects of the dominion that we have. When God placed human beings in the Garden of Eden, he gave them work to do. Work, in fact, predates the fall. To take it one step further, Genesis portrays a God who works. You'll notice it says in Genesis 2, verse 1, so in 6 days God ceased from all of his labors and rested on the seventh day. He's been laboring, he's been working. God is a worker. If God's a worker, how can we view work as negative? And further, as I said, when he places human beings in the Garden of Eden, he gives them work to do. The first thing he tells them is, tells Adam, name the animals. Now, that may not seem like much of a job, but I want you to think about this for a second. In Hebrew, the idea in Hebrew culture, in Jewish culture, is that your name should reflect your nature. Thus, you'll notice when people have significant encounters with God in the Old Testament, frequently God changes their name because they've become a new person when they have this encounter with God, and therefore their name has to change. Abram to Abraham, Sarai to Sarah, Jacob to Israel. Your name is supposed to reflect your nature. So if Adam is to name the animals, he has to understand the nature of those animals, which means he's got to study them, he's got to come to understand them, so that he can give them their proper name. That is the work of science. It's taxonomy, it's really the foundation of science. The naming the animals is a mandate to do science. Then it says, tend and protect the garden. If you read the description of the Garden of Eden, the first thing it says about the Garden of Eden is that it's a place of beauty. Trees that are a delight to the eyes. Oh, and by the way, they also bear fruit that's good to eat. That's the second thing it says about them. So tending the garden must mean two things. It must mean tending to beauty, taking care of the beauty. In other words, that's a mandate to do art. And the other is producing the fruit that you're going to eat. So that's production, that's economic activity. All of that's included. We've got science, we've got art, and we've got economic production included in the work that God gave Adam and Eve in the garden. That's all part of dominion. If you look at the trajectory of Genesis, what it shows is God starts with a formless and void earth. He proceeds to shape it. He proceeds to create inhabitants for it. And then he says to Adam, Adam, I'm putting you in charge now. Finish it up. Develop culture. Cultivate art. Cultivate beauty. Cultivate the sciences. Start families, reproduce, multiply, build society, build culture. Finish the work I began. That's what human beings were created to do. That is the mandate that God gave Adam and Eve in the garden. And further, you'll notice one other thing. He says, eat the fruit of any tree in the garden. That one over there, avoid that one. But other than that, you can eat the fruit of any tree in the garden. Cultivate what you want. You like raspberries, grow raspberries. You know, you have freedom. You have complete freedom, but don't eat poison. It's really what God tells them in Genesis, in the garden. So what he's saying to them is, as you tend and protect the garden, it's going to bear fruit. And you know what? You have the right to that fruit. Quite literally, you have the right to the fruit of your labor. Keep that in mind. That's going to come back. Now, the problem, of course, is that when God said to Adam and Eve, don't eat the fruit of this one tree, they said, excuse me, which one is it? And they got really kind of interested, and then Satan came along and lied to them, got them to doubt God's word to them, and they ate the thing that God told them not to eat. And then God has no choice. God is God of justice. He's got to pronounce judgment on them. Now, interestingly enough, this is not an economic issue at this point. He told them that the day they ate it, they would die. Well, we talk about spiritual death and things like that, but that's not what God meant when he said, when you eat it, you'll die. He meant you will die. And Adam and Eve didn't die that day, but something did. You will notice that God replaces Adam and Eve's fig leaves with animal skins. Something died, and it died in Adam and Eve's place. It's the first substitutionary sacrifice pointing ahead to the work of Christ. But for our purposes, what's more important is the judgment that God gives to Adam and Eve. He says to Eve, rather famously, because you did what I told you not to do, I'm going to greatly increase your pain in childbirth. That hits the first part of the creation mandate, reproduce and multiply and fill the earth. There's a judgment on that. You're going to do this. You are still going to reproduce and multiply and fill the earth, but you're going to do it with pain. Then he says to Adam, when you cultivate the ground, you're going to do it with pain. It's the same word. What was intended to be joyful labor is going to turn to painful toil. You're still going to do it, but it's going to be pain. Which is why today most of us consider our jobs a pain. The judgment that falls on them, in essence, says, you continue to be my stewards on the earth. How do we know that? In Genesis 9, after the flood, God says to Noah, whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed, for man is made in the image of God. That's an important verse for other reasons, which we'll get to later. But for now, just note that man is still designated the image of God even after the flood. So we retain our job as God's stewards and regents of the earth. But because of the curse that is placed, because of the curse that follows the fall, our job gets harder on all levels. And that is actually why the ancient world viewed work as drudgery. It had turned into that. It wasn't supposed to be that, but that's what it turned into. The Jews retained the idea that work is a noble thing and is something that is good because God himself did it, but nobody else did. Well, Christianity comes along. And one of the things that happens with the atonement, Jesus dies on the cross for our sins. One of the key points that you need to understand is that the atonement is understood as extending to all aspects of the fall. It restores our relationship with God, which has been broken by our sin. It restores our relationship with each other, which has been broken by our sin. You'll notice one of the first things that happens is that Adam begins blaming Eve. Oh, and by the way, he's not only blaming Eve, he's blaming God. God says to him, why'd you eat of this? He says, that woman that you gave me the fruit to eat. So he's blaming Eve, passing the buck to his wife, and God as well. So the relationships are broken there. They're feeling shame. So they've got a brokenness with their relationship with themselves. The fall points to a brokenness in their relationship with the world, as well as a serious impairment on their fundamental purpose in life, which God had given them, which was to build culture to glorify him. Christ's death and his redemption is intended to deal with all of these aspects of the fall. We are really big on talking about reconciliation with God, and that's great. That's really important. It's also supposed to help us deal with our reconciliation with each other. We're reasonably good at that, although we could be better. It's supposed to help us deal with our own psychological issues, many of which, not all, but many of which really come from guilt. And if we really understand the forgiveness that's available to us in Christ, that guilt shouldn't be there. In the guilt in the psychological sense, in the objective sense, the guilt is there, but it's dealt with. It should also mean that we have a renewed relationship with the natural world and with our work. It should actually, if Christ's atonement extends to all aspects of the fall, it should reverse the curse. And therefore, we need to think about work differently and we need to think about redeeming work. And that, in fact, is what's going to start happening very, very early on. St. Benedict of Nursia, the founder of Western monasticism, understood this. And what he did when he wrote his rule for the life of the monks, the people who were living within his monasteries, one of the things he specified in there was every monk has to engage in productive work of one sort or another because we were made to work. This is what God created us to do. Work is a good thing. He's very clear about this. He's got a positive attitude toward work. And so the monks are told to work. So the monks begin working. However, as time goes on, and it doesn't take very long actually, they begin to realize a couple of things. Work is good, but mindless drudgery, toil, repetitive stuff is a result of the fall. It's drudgery, it's painful toil. Christ redeemed us from that. We need to think about ways to eliminate that kind of mindless activity. So if we can get an animal to do something rather than having a human being do it, we should have the animal do it because then that frees up the human being to do more valuable work, more fulfilling work. And if we can get a machine to do the work rather than an animal, that's even better. So what you find is that the monks of medieval Europe are the first people to start systematically deploying water wheels to mechanize mindless, repetitive tasks. The Roman Empire knew about water wheels, and there are a few Roman wheels out there, but there are very few, because they had slaves to do the work. Why invest the capital that you need to build a water wheel, which is a pretty complex mechanism, really? Why invest all of that when you've got a slave to do it anyway? What do you need it for? In the Middle Ages, they start saying, no, work needs to be made more meaningful. We're going to start putting water wheels in place. The Irish monks are the first to do this that we know about. And already by the 600s, maybe earlier, they've got tidal wheels, wheels powered by the tides going in and out. They've got overshot wheels, they've got undershot wheels, they've got all the variations of water wheels we've got. They're doing it. And they're using this specifically because they are trying to make work more meaningful and, for that matter, more productive. Why not? If you believe work is a good thing, but you believe toil is the effect of sin, shouldn't we try to relieve the effects of sin? That's what mechanization was originally intended to do. It was intended to remove drudgery, to mitigate the effects of the fall, because these things should be turned around because what Jesus did. From there, water wheels are adapted to a whole bunch of other uses. Originally, it's grinding grain, but they do everything from ultimately powering suction pumps in mines, fulling mills in cloth production, trip hammers in smithies, bellows in forges, sawmills, on and on and on. They begin being used in all of these different ways in the Middle Ages. They start spreading initially in the monasteries, then they spread into the secular world as well. And the point of this is, again, this idea of the elimination of drudgery. That is really the central idea here, to make work meaningful again. The net effect of all of this, and this is documented by a sociologist named Rodney Stark, the net effect of all of this is you begin getting early forms of capitalism in these medieval monasteries. You get ideas like, you know, work is good, production is good. When we produce a surplus, we can give a certain amount away to the poor around us, but we've got extra surplus above that because, you know, we can't, the population density isn't high enough. We don't have that many poor people around. We can help the ones we've got. We've still got extra. What are we going to do with it? Well, the idea is that if work and production is good, then investing surplus into additional production must also be good. So you get this idea of reinvesting profit to increase production, either to improve the land or get more land or whatever. And so you end up getting this cycle that's fundamental to capitalism of using your capital, your resources, to increase your economic activity rather than just to spend it or give it away or save it. So that's going on. And then along with that, you also see them starting to do money lending and things like that because they have surplus. And people need, they are not, monks are supposed to live a fairly strict lifestyle, and they can't spend all the money they've got. So they do reinvest some, and some of it early on, they actually start lending out to nobles and other people who need cash. This eventually gets stopped by the church because they don't like the idea of charging interest, and they don't like the idea of giving money away without it. So that eventually gets put down. But early on, the monasteries are doing all of these things that we associate with the much more advanced commercial societies. Anyway, next step. Okay, so work has improved considerably as a result of this, and the trajectory started in the Middle Ages are continuing to today with this idea of mechanization and elimination of drudgery and so on. The entire idea of a knowledge economy in many ways comes from this. Now, the next important factor in Western economics is the idea of property rights. The foundation for this is in the Garden of Eden. John Locke talked about what he called the labor theory of property. If you work for something, you deserve to own that something that you have worked for. If you produce something, that something is yours. Okay? And this has its roots in the garden. Remember, tend the garden and you can eat the fruit from it. The idea that you have the right to the fruit of your labor is the foundation, ultimately, of Western concepts of property rights. And again, this is John Locke, the labor theory of property. It's not the labor theory of value, that's something else. Labor theory of property from John Locke. You also see this through the Old Testament. If you look at the Decalogue, if you look at the Ten Commandments, thou shalt not steal implies property rights. If you don't have a right to private property, there's no theft. So even the Ten Commandments point to this idea that you have the right to your property. Land ownership. Notice how many of the laws in the Old Testament focus on land ownership. You know, there are serious penalties for stealing people's land, even by simply moving boundary markers. The importance of the land cannot be overestimated in the Old Testament. It is central to Israel's life. As a matter of fact, my favorite example of this comes from the northern kingdom of Israel, King Ahab, the worst king the northern kingdom ever had. This is a guy he marries. It talks about all the evil things that he does. And then it says, and on top of all of this, he added to all of this evil, well, he married Jezebel. Despite introducing idolatry into Israel, despite bringing in priests of Baal, despite sponsoring false prophets, despite persecuting Christians, persecuting the faithful followers of the Lord, despite all of this, do you know what is the thing that got God to finally declare Ahab unredeemable? It was the theft of property. He wanted a vineyard. The guy wouldn't sell it to him. He said, this is my ancestral land. I can't give this up. He got in a sulk about it. Jezebel set the guy up, got some people to lie, said he cursed the Lord. They stoned him to death, and then Jezebel told Ahab to just take the property. Now, it's not the murder that's really the key here. How do I know that? He'd already killed a whole lot of other people, including prophets. It was stealing the land that was the thing that got God finally to say, Ahab, your descendants are going to be eaten by the dogs in the street. Your history. That's when God pronounces the irrevocable judgment on him. That's how important land ownership was. In other words, that's how seriously God took private property. Now, in the case of Israel, owning land and things like that had more significance than just property rights, but property rights were certainly a key part of it. Now, people will tell you, okay, in the Old Testament you have all of this, but when you get to the book of Acts, you see something different. In Acts, it says they held all things in common. That means there really wasn't any private property. If they're holding all things in common, there's no private property. So in the New Testament ideal is the elimination of private property. My answer? Not so fast. First of all, given that's only an example of a single church in Jerusalem and you don't see that anywhere else, this should raise some questions. And secondly, if you read the account of the church in Jerusalem, it's not what it seems. You will notice, for example, when you read it, right after it says, and they held all things in common, it says, whenever anyone had any need, someone would sell their property and bring the proceeds in, and they would be distributed to meet the needs. In other words, people still owned property, or they wouldn't be able to sell it. When they say they held all things in common, it's hyperbole, a rhetorical device that means exaggeration for emphasis. How do we know that? The very explanation points to that. What it is saying is that people valued each other within the community more than they valued their own property. And so when there was a need, people willingly gave up their property to meet the needs of their neighbors because they cared more about them than they did about their wealth. It's a very different thing from the kind of communal ownership that the phrase suggests. And when you look at the text, that's what it points to. And to put an exclamation point on this, right after the discussion of all of this, you have the story of Ananias and Sapphira. Ananias and Sapphira, husband and wife, they sold some land. They kept part of the proceeds for themselves, and they brought the rest to the apostles. And they gave it to them. And they said, we sold our land, here's the money. Peter, through the Holy Spirit, knew they were lying. And he says to Ananias, Sapphira's not there at this point, he says to Ananias, wasn't the land yours in the first place? And after you sold it, wasn't the money yours? Why are you lying to the Holy Spirit and say you're bringing all of it in? Just tell us you're bringing some of it in. That's fine. He doesn't actually say that, but that's kind of the implication. The fact that he wanted to keep some of it, but get the credit for giving all of it, he was lying to the church. He was lying to the Holy Spirit. And that's what brought judgment on him. But you'll notice what Peter says. Wasn't the property yours? And when you sold it, wasn't the money yours? In other words, the church in Jerusalem accepted implicitly and without argument the right to private property, even in the so-called community of goods that you see there. So that all things in common phrase, like I said, it's hyperbole, it's exaggeration for emphasis. It's talking more about their attitude toward their property than the actual economic structure of the community. Oh, and by the way, you'll notice right after Ananias and Sapphira, you will find that it wasn't working really well either. So they had to introduce the deacons to make sure that all the funds were distributed appropriately. Okay. But anyway, that's the church in Jerusalem. So the fact is that property rights are found in both the Old and New Testament, your major counterexample being the church in Acts, which isn't really a counterexample when you look at it closely. Now, in the Middle Ages, people took these ideas and developed them further. The guy on the right there is William of Ockham. Ockham was a Franciscan theologian who, on the basis of the passages of Scripture that I've talked about, said that property rights were unalienable. That is to say, they were granted by God. They are pre-political. That is to say, they predate government because Adam and Eve had the right to property in the garden, and therefore government cannot arbitrarily take your property away from you. You have property rights that are given by God and that cannot be taken away. This is coming from a Franciscan, a guy who took a vow of poverty. I find that rather amusing. Now, along with this, there's an implicit point in all of this, and that's the idea of the rule of law. The rule of law is critical to the Western economic tradition, not just the political tradition, because what it says is that the government has limitations. There are unalienable rights that you have, including the right to property. And the government, therefore, cannot come in and arbitrarily confiscate your land or your wealth or anything else. You have the right to your property. The government can collect taxes for its legitimate functions, but aside from that, your property is sacrosanct. Now consider, in contrast to this, the Muslim world. Within Islam, the sultan had the right to take anything from anybody he wanted to at will. So a really good example of how this works out in practice is a battle that took place in 1572 called the Battle of Lepanto. This is a major sea battle that really prevented the Ottoman Turks from expanding into the Western Mediterranean. It's really a critical battle in history. And at the sea battle, a combined force of Spanish, Papal, Venetian, Genoese ships met in a navy to face the Ottoman navy, and it was a spectacular victory for the Christian side. In the process of the battle, they captured the galley, the flagship, of Ali Pasha. Ali Pasha was the commander of the Ottoman fleet. And when they captured his flagship, they discovered on the flagship that he was carrying his entire private fortune in gold. It was all in that galley. Why was it in the galley? Because he didn't dare leave it at home, because if the Sultan got mad at him, he would confiscate it. No Western leader ever had that fear, because they knew that the government didn't have the right to confiscate property. They'd have to bring them on trial, they'd have to convict them for treason, something like that, before the government could confiscate property. It couldn't be done arbitrarily. And that's because of the idea of rule of law, and because property rights are unalienable. They predate government. Now, when you combine the technological innovations of the Middle Ages, by the way, when we talk about the Industrial Revolution, we're usually talking about the late 18th and 19th century. There was an Industrial Revolution in the Middle Ages. The number of inventions that come out, most of which, by the way, are aimed at improving the work of laborers, the number of inventions is staggering. Vishal Mangalwadi, an Indian philosopher, Christian, has commented that the West is unique in its development of technologies because there were a lot of other countries that had technologies far in advance of those of the Western world. But in those other countries, the technologies were playthings for the wealthy. Only in the West was technology developed to make the work of the common laborer better. Okay, so that kind of technological stuff with drudgery, eliminating drudgery that I talked about before, and it's Christian motivations there again, that kind of thing, plus this idea of rule of law and the right of private property meant that you get, well, first of all, an industrial revolution in the Middle Ages, but you also get an increasing prosperity in the Middle Ages from about the year 1000 to roughly 1300, and then it slows down considerably after that due to minor problems like the Black Death, which killed 48% of the population of Europe in 2 years. That's going to slow down economic development. But there is a huge expansion of the economy during this period, which means, by the way, that they also have to figure out things to do, you know, ways of financing this. You've got to figure out how you're going to fund this, because you need capital if you're going to have economic expansion. So you begin getting various kinds of contracts that are developed, things like, well, commendas and other sorts of things that I'm not going to get into here. You begin getting financial instruments to deal with the fact that you've got different currencies being involved in being used in different parts of Europe, bills of exchange, things like that. You begin getting primitive forms of insurance like sea loans. You get the invention of banking during this period, where they're lending money at interest and giving interest to the money that's lent to you. You get the equivalent of bonding for governments. You get all kinds of financial instruments that develop to further encourage the development of the economy. Actually, you go by the 15th century, you've got double-entry bookkeeping. You can use modern accounting techniques on medieval 15th century Italian books to do complete audits and things like that of them. Anything you can do with modern auditing, you can do with these things. They're that accurate. So you've got all of these things that develop, and all of these things mean that Europe is becoming increasingly prosperous during the Middle Ages. And that's where you've got a problem, a psychological problem that sets in. And that's that you have this ideal in the medieval world, promoted in the Catholic Church, of poverty. Poverty is seen as a spiritually superior state. Jesus says in Luke, the Beatitudes in Luke, it says, blessed are the poor, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Matthew says poor in spirit. Luke just says, blessed are the poor. Jesus says, you know, somebody says to him, I'll follow you wherever you go. And Jesus says, you know, foxes have dens and birds have nests, but I don't even have any place to lay my head. Jesus tells the rich young ruler, go sell everything you have, give to the poor, and come follow me. Jesus says, woe to the rich. Woe to you who are rich. There are all kinds of things that they point to in the Gospels that say that, you know, wealth isn't all it's cracked up to be, and poverty is a good thing. And further, let's take it a step beyond that and note that the poor are, at least presumably, humble because they've got to rely on other people to support them. And in fact, the poor are even a benefit to the community because they give other people the opportunity to be generous. So poverty is a virtue. This creates a kind of salvation anxiety in the Middle Ages, because as the society is becoming increasingly prosperous, they've got to ask the question, what does this mean? Am I losing my salvation because I'm getting rich? I'm prospering. I'm doing better. What does this mean in terms of my salvation? The net result is that there are a whole series of very, very disruptive reform movements that take place in the Middle Ages, all of which center on the issue of wealth or poverty, particularly the wealth or poverty of the church, but even the issue of wealth or poverty of individuals. They don't really know how to deal with this. And that issue, this problem, this tension that exists between this ideal of poverty and economic prosperity isn't really resolved until you get to the Reformation. In the period of the Reformation, poverty is no longer seen as virtuous. There's enough economic instability floating around that people start questioning this idea of the virtues of poverty, even within the Catholic world. Increasingly, the sense is that if you are able-bodied and capable of working, you should work. You shouldn't beg. Now, if you cannot work, if you are sick or injured or old or crippled or anything like that, that's a different matter. But if you're capable of working, if you're a so-called sturdy beggar, to use the old English phrase, if you're a sturdy beggar, you should be working. And if you're not working, you need to leave town. They would literally whip people out of town during this period if they were sturdy beggars. Now, the deserving poor, the people who are poor through no fault of their own, those are the people you ought to take care of. And so what's going to happen is as you're moving through the 16th century, this is touching on what we're going to do tomorrow, but as you move through the 16th century, the different cities in Europe are going to begin setting up systems for taking care of their poor, the deserving poor, while they drive out the sturdy beggars, okay, or force them to work. Now, so poverty is no longer virtuous. They're no longer looking at this as a good thing, which, by the way, implies that prosperity is a good thing. If poverty is not a virtue, then we're not going to worry about prosperity. Work, in the Reformation especially, work is increasingly seen as a vocation. Now, this isn't something that we would think of as unusual today, but trust me, in this period, and actually even much later in many parts of the world, this is a radical concept. In the Catholic Church to this day, if you say someone has a vocation, what it means is that they're in the clergy. They're a priest, a monk, a nun. That's what a vocation is. The word vocation, vocatio, is the Latin word for a calling. It comes from the word for calling. And the idea in the Catholic world is the only calling from God that really exists, God is the one who does the call, the only calling that really exists is to the church. In the Protestant world, they've got a different idea. In the Protestant world, they begin saying, wait a minute, anything can be a calling from God. Any legitimate profession. Legitimate meaning non-criminal, non-sinful. If you are called to be a cobbler, that can be a vocation from God. And you serve God as a cobbler, not by putting little crosses on your shoes, but by making excellent shoes. That's the way you give glory to God, following the vocation of a carpenter. That's a paraphrase, very, very close paraphrase, of the words of Martin Luther. The idea here is God created the entire universe. There is nothing that God didn't create. There is nothing that human beings do that is not under the lordship of Christ. Remember, Jesus is Lord. That means he is Lord of all areas of life. Abraham Kuyper famously said, there is not a single square inch in the whole domain of human experience over which Christ, who is Lord of all, does not cry out, mine. And if he says mine, we should say his. So what that means is, if you are a cobbler making shoes, you are doing something that is holy work because Christ is Lord of that. If you are a farmer tending your crops in the field, you are doing holy work because God made that field and makes those crops grow. Everything, any legitimate job, can be a vocation from God. And the Protestants, and especially the Reformed Protestants, the Calvinist world, grabbed hold of this idea and ran with it. We're back to the idea of what is known to theologians as the cultural mandate. This idea that in the garden, God told Adam and Eve, you've got a job to do. You need to build culture. You need to build families. You need to build civilization. You need to develop the world that I gave you and bring it to its fullness under my authority and for my glory. The Protestants recover that, especially, like I said, the Reformed, the Calvinist branch. And they run with it, and they put a huge amount of emphasis on this. And then you will get with Locke. Locke will develop this idea in the 17th century. He will codify this idea coming out of Genesis of the labor theory of property. So you have this constellation of things that says that work, economic activity, production, all of these kinds of things are a sacred calling, and you have the right to the benefits of this that is given by God that you should rejoice in and be glad that you have it. There's nothing to be ashamed of, nothing to be embarrassed about prospering as you do God's work. By the way, you should also not use your money frivolously. You should not waste it, okay? Because that is also a resource that is entrusted to you by God. And anybody want to get rich? Here's your formula. Work hard and don't spend everything you make. In the Protestant world, that was the ideal. You're going to work hard because it's a calling from God, and your work is supposed to be done as unto the Lord, not unto man. And you are going to be careful with your money. You're not going to waste it on things that are frivolous. You're going to use that to the glory of God as well. Net result, the people who followed this practice ended up prospering. The effect of all of this is you begin to develop, by the 18th century, a clear idea of free market economics, free market capitalism. The guy on the right there is Adam Smith. I'll mention him in a minute. The idea of free market capitalism is, since property rights are inalienable, they're pre-political, they predate God, you have the right to do with your money what you want. And so, if you produce goods, you have the right to dispose of those goods as you want. So what free market capitalism really involves is the free exchange of goods between individuals or organizations with minimal government interference. It comes from the idea of property rights. It comes from the idea of rule of law. It comes from all these things we've talked about before. And it is anchored fundamentally in biblical principles and in biblical and theologians' reflections on the biblical text. This also implies, in the long run, the idea that you can use your profits to reinvest in further production, all of those kinds of things. But fundamentally, it's about the idea that you have the right and the freedom, the legitimate freedom, to sell your goods to anybody you want to for a price that is mutually agreed upon. And you, in turn, have the right to use your money to buy goods at a mutually agreed upon price without the government stepping in and messing with it. This emerges in the wake of multiple other concepts of economics that are developing during this period. There's one group that we today call mercantilists that believed that the wealth of a nation is determined by the balance of trade. If they export more than they import, the nation will prosper. And so they set up all kinds of tariffs and barriers and things like that for goods coming in, and they had policies to encourage the sale of goods on the outside. That's government interference. And it distorts the market, and free market people are, like Adam Smith and Edmund Burke, more on them in a second, argued against this. The physiocrats were a group in France that believed that wealth was determined by land and population. So you want to encourage the most development of the land, and you want to encourage population, and it also involves a lot of government manipulation and interference. Free market people say, no, that's not going to work either. Now, the interesting thing about this is that by the time you're getting into the late 18th and early 19th century, this becomes sort of a common belief across the board. Adam Smith wrote The Wealth of Nations in 1776. He's considered the father of classic liberalism. Edmund Burke is writing in the early 19th century. His essays on the French Revolution is one of his most important works. He's considered the father of classic conservatism. So you've got the father of classic liberalism and the father of classic conservatism, but both of them agree on free market economics. It's really rather remarkable. This is an idea that is, people have worked out the logical implications of many of the theological ideas about money that we talked about before, and they all come to about the same conclusion on it. Now, there are challenges that have come up to this, and with this I will close. There are various forms of Christian socialism that are out there that argue that wealth is inherently corrupting, that it's really all about greed and things like that, and free market economics is really, you know, fundamentally about greed and about the rich becoming richer and the poor becoming poorer. So they frequently advocate various types of communes and things like that, frequently based on a misreading, I would argue, of Acts. There are a lot of examples of this. So we have, for example, some of the historic Anabaptist groups coming out of the Reformation, like the Hutterites. You've got a bunch of 19th century sects that do communal life. Liberal Protestantism frequently will make an argument of this sort, although they don't typically go quite the route of communes. They move more in the direction of socialism, where they're arguing that the government really is the one that should have the right to determine a lot of the redistribution of wealth. Liberation theology is essentially Christianized Marxism, same kind of thing. And the evangelical left and neo-Anabaptists today within the evangelical community also argue for this sort of thing. And, you know, so there's a fair number of people out there who make the argument. And unfortunately, there are a number of good responses to them, well thought out, sane biblical responses that people are just unaware of. People don't know about them, and so they don't really know how to answer the challenges these guys come up with. Two books I would recommend on that, if you're interested, are Jay Richards' Money, Greed, and God, and secondly, Father Robert Sirico, I'm blanking out on the name. It's something like The Moral Good of Capitalism. That's not exactly it, but it's something along those lines. Both books are excellent. Both of them very readable. If you want to see a solid biblical defense that answers the challenges raised by these guys, I'd recommend either of those. The best response that I know, though, ultimately comes from a Catholic theologian named Michael Novak. He wrote a book called The Spirit of Democratic Capitalism. And in this book, Novak argued that the modern free enterprise-based system, modern democratic capitalist system, is essentially a three-legged stool. It is built around three essential premises: political freedom, economic freedom, and moral restraint. He says it is a three-legged stool, and if you remove any one of those legs, the stool will collapse. The problem that we have, and this is the reason why capitalism is in something of a crisis now, the problem isn't with capitalism, it's with a number of, I would say two things. First of all, distortions of the market by the government. The government has been interfering in a lot of things that has introduced all kinds of distortions in the market. The problems with that, I can't get into why that's a problem. I'd refer you to either of the books I just mentioned. But the other part of it is the lack of moral restraint. The fact of the matter is our culture has taught for too long in our schools the idea of essentially moral relativity, situational ethics, moral relativity, that there is no such thing as an absolute right or wrong. And we've now got a generation of people who were taught that and who believe it. And so when they get into power in companies, they act in ways that are immoral and unethical, that if they think they can get away with it. Because fundamentally, they don't have a moral foundation. And what happens when that occurs is the moral restraint leg of the stool collapses. And that then forces something to try to redress the balance. And what ends up happening then is the government typically will step in to try to replace the leg that should be moral restraint. And it does this by more and more heavy-handed regulation, crony capitalism, and all kinds of things like that. And that's when the whole system starts falling apart. That's when it collapses. And that's really the situation that we're facing now in a lot of ways. If you think about what I said earlier about civil society, the image here, and this is courtesy of Kuiper, is Kuiper calls this sphere sovereignty, the idea that there are a number of autonomous spheres out there. Not everything is the government. There are these civil society autonomous spheres that should be self-governing. But what happens is when a sphere collapses, when a sphere doesn't govern itself correctly, when it collapses, when moral restraint is lost in the economic sphere, in the business sphere, something has to come in to replace it. And what inevitably steps in to replace it is the government. And what that means is the government is moving into an area that it is, number one, ill-equipped to deal with because government isn't designed to function in that sphere. And number two, it is usurping power that is not properly its, with the net result that every time a sphere collapses and the government is forced to step in, it brings us closer and closer to tyranny. Because tyranny can be defined as the government taking on responsibilities and taking authority in areas that are not properly its. So the challenge that we are facing now really is the fact that we are in a situation where because of the lack of moral restraint, that leg of the stool has been pulled out, and that's resulted in a collapse in the economic sphere in many ways, which has invited the government to come in and through heavy-handed means try to correct it. By the way, we are also seeing other spheres collapsing. The sphere of family is collapsing, and government is stepping in there in loco parentis, literally, in the place of the parents. They're stepping in to replace the parents. We're seeing a sphere of education collapsing. The government is moving into that area in spades. So we've got all of these various areas of collapsing spheres all happening simultaneously at a point at which the government is busy extending its reach further and further into areas that are, number one, not constitutional, but number two, are not properly part of the government's God-given responsibilities, which results in a loss of freedom, results in tyranny, and a whole host of other things. But it's seen most clearly in many ways in what's happening in the economy, because the fundamental principles that have shaped the economic system of the West, these free market principles derived from the Bible ultimately, are being more and more eclipsed by government, by other ideas that are creeping in because fundamentally of the loss of moral restraint in some sectors of industry. And that's what really has produced this entire notion of the 1%, the class warfare and everything else we see. A lot of that is rhetoric, but a lot of it is really brought on, frankly, by the corporations themselves because of that problem, that lack of moral restraint. Fundamentally, economics cannot function without ethics, without morality. And that's really the challenge that we're facing now. How do we rebuild an ethical climate within that sphere and push the government back out where it belongs, out of the area where it doesn't fit? So that's really kind of the challenge we're facing right now. And with that, we are done for the evening. If we have time, I can take some questions.
Denny.
Glenn, when you're talking about the development of financial institutions, I couldn't help but wonder, it seems like insurance didn't come far behind those. And what was the relationship between material consequences and not faith in God there?
There are early forms of insurance that already develop in the Middle Ages. They go by names like sea loans and things like that, where basically you will get a group of people who will pool money together to sponsor a series of voyages with the assumption that if one of them goes down, the others will make up the difference. I mean, so you have things like that that are sort of similar to insurance pools today. The insurance industry itself, as formal insurance, I'm not as up on the history of that. That's actually a bit of a later development. And there is, in fact, as you suggest, I do know that there are some people who object to it because of this issue of lack of faith in God. You know, if you're trusting God, then you shouldn't really buy insurance because that suggests you're trying to protect yourself and not relying on God. That argument is, in fact, made. I think it is really short-sighted, and I think it is very presumptuous. Because as God gives us opportunity, we are expected to provide for ourselves, and not only ourselves, but for other people as well. We need to be able to, well, in Proverbs it says that the wise man stores up wealth for his grandchildren, his children's children. In Timothy, Paul tells us that we're supposed to take care of not just our children, but our parents. And I think it may even go up to grandparents, if I'm not mistaken. So what that means is we're responsible for taking care of people two generations up and two generations down. That's a tough thing to do. But as different kinds of opportunities arise, prudence, which is a virtue, suggests that we take advantage of them. So that when insurance is developed, it is simply a prudential step to take advantage of that and to make sure that your family is taken care of if anything happens to you. Or to make sure that if you get sick, you're not going to bankrupt the family taking care of you. That, like I said, that it seems to me is simple practical wisdom, prudence, which is in Proverbs is a virtue. So I don't really buy the argument that it demonstrates a lack of faith. But you are right, people did make that argument. Like I said, to me, I just don't see it.
If I remember correctly, I think Jay Richards comments or works on that a little, that idea a little bit in Money, Greed, and God. It's been a while since I reread that book for the third time. If you haven't read it for the first time, I recommend it to you. Another question.
Thank you for being here. You didn't talk too much about the judicial system of our government, and that seems to be pretty prevalent that they're getting involved in things, but maybe that's tomorrow too. But
yeah, the judicial system doesn't fit in with the themes that I was talking about. The fundamental idea behind the judicial system was that it would act as a referee. Thomas Jefferson was really, really worried about that provision of the Constitution. He referred to the judiciary, and I quote, as the despotic branch. And he said that the problem with this is that it could turn the Constitution into a nose of wax, meaning it could be grabbed and twisted into any shape it wants. And Jefferson was afraid of that. For the first century or more, there was very little of that that went on. As you move into the 20th century, though, a number of issues come up that really change that, one of them being the idea that the Constitution is a living document. And like any living documents, it should evolve, like any living thing. This is in the wake of Darwinism, actually, yes. The idea is really emerges that the we shouldn't really be bound by old documents. They should always be updated, reinterpreted, and reshaped to suit current conditions. And that, in fact, the original intent of the founders is not entirely relevant anymore. So once that idea sets in, which really comes out of the progressive movement in a lot of ways, once that idea sets in, the judiciary then sees itself as having the right to invent rights out of whole cloth, to reinterpret the Constitution in ways completely foreign to the original intent, and so on.
Other questions? No questions. One of the things that intrigued me, Glenn, in the last couple of chapters of why you think the way you do is what you had to say about Darwin's impact even on feminism and so forth. I don't know if you're going to comment on that or if that's a good breakfast discussion.
The echo got to me here. You walked to the other side and I couldn't hear you. What's impact?
How Darwinism impacted, was that feminism and so forth kind of flowed out of Darwinian thinking and so forth.
Mm-hmm. The short version of this is that as you're moving into the 19th century, there's a real push toward atheism among a lot of the intellectual elites. But there are two problems that stand in their way. One of them is the origin of the universe, and the second is the origin of humanity, because human beings were seen as being radically different from anything else in the universe. The first was solved by resurrecting an ancient Greek idea that the universe is eternal. So it doesn't have a beginning, therefore you don't need God to start it. Now, we happen to know because of the Big Bang and things like that that that's wrong, but they didn't know that then, and they gleefully grabbed hold of it as a way of getting rid of God. But that still left the problem of humanity. Darwin comes along, and Darwin says, excuse me, human beings really aren't different qualitatively from animals. They just have a different set of adaptations. And once that idea comes in, it eliminates the idea of the uniqueness of humanity. It gives a new idea of our origins. We're just essentially highly complex slime, and we're no different from anything else. And once that is in place, it eliminates all need for God entirely. And that's what, was it Dawkins, I think it is, said that the beauty of Darwinism is it makes it possible to be an intellectually fulfilled atheist.
Darwin had his fingers and fingerprints on a lot of things. Thank you for coming this evening. Do help us out with a check before you leave. Thanks for coming.